Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today, in the first part of the show, we are replaying an interview that aired last year during the Santa Fe Film Festival about a film called The Sensation of Sight. And this film is opening this weekend, starting August 29th, at the Santa Fe Film Center. Joining us by telephone right now is Aaron Wiederspun, and he is the writer and director of this film. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great. Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate it.
This is an amazing film. It's about the, I guess you would say, the personal aftermath of a horrible tragedy, of a person's death. But you wrote it in such a way that we, the audience, don't know for quite a while what the tragedy actually was, even while we see its effects on all of these people. Why did you choose to keep this a mystery until relatively late in the film?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that I wanted to do, and one of my, you know, general aspirations as a filmmaker is to try to create a space where I invite the audience in to use their mind and head and sort of try to put the pieces together. And I also, you know, was dealing with, you know, obviously, you know, a serious issue with the tragedy, and due to the content and just the nature of the way despair works in people's, you know, in people's lives, and you know, like Thoreau said, you know, many men lead lives of quiet desperation. I really wanted to sort of take my time with that and really try to bring people into the milieu as far as, you know, how tragedy affects people and how despair works on people's lives. And really sort of take my time with that and slowly unravel it.
I was wondering what the inspiration was, and if it had to do with the question that the main character, Finn, asks at various points during the movie, namely the big question of why.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, interestingly enough, this idea came about from I had a recurring dream. You know, one night I had this dream. I saw this man selling encyclopedias. You know, it was a curious thing, and then I had it a second time, and then a third time, so I was struck by, well, why? Why am I having this dream? And so I started writing about this character, and why became the big issue. Why is this man selling encyclopedias? That's a big question right there, and especially in a day and age when people no longer sell encyclopedias, why is this? Who is this man? And what has brought him to a place where such a thing would happen?
It's amazing that you got that image from a dream. After the third time, did you realize that this was meant to be a part of a film?
Well, you know, I mean, I wondered. I mean, I'm very image-driven. So, you know, became this sort of iconic thing to me where I saw this man, he's pulling this wagon, toting around these encyclopedias. So, you know, I thought maybe there was an inkling of an idea there, or, you know, or something that may be worth exploring. And as soon as I started writing ideas down and sort of plumbing the well of what this may possibly be, I quickly found out that, you know, I thought it'd be a very interesting story.
I thought one of the things in it that was interesting was that you talked about the different ways that people deal with despair. And this is really, the movie is, among other things, a study in that. And one of the ways that you can see what the character is like is which letter of the alphabet of the encyclopedia they buy.
Yeah. yeah, that's something that I just sort of layered in there, you know, and it's all there for a purpose, but I sort of leave it open and leave a bit of ambiguity there, you know, and because I'd like each audience member to bring their own personal subjective experience to the film, and hopefully each person may take a little something different away from it that might have a bit of personal resonance for them.
We're talking about the film The Sensation of Sight, which opens this weekend, August 29th, at the Santa Fe Film Center. The acting is really incredible. David Strathairn plays the lead character, Finn, Jane Addams, Anne Cusack, Elizabeth Waterston, the daughter of Sam Waterston. All incredible. How did you put together this cast?
Well, I was very, very fortunate. This is my first feature film, and so, you know, anytime you make your first venture, you never know what's going to happen, and in regards to the cast. I was very, very fortunate. And it started with my producing partner, Buzz McLaughlin, had a Playwrights Development Theater that he had founded in New Jersey, the Playwrights Theater of New Jersey, back in like the 80s. And around that time when he was just starting the theater, David Strathairn lived in the neighboring town and came over. They became good friends, and David was involved in about 6 stage readings at that company. And they hadn't been in touch for quite some time, you know, many years. And when we were talking about doing the film, I've been a big fan of David's, and I think he's an impeccable actor. And I said, you know, he'd be perfect for this. So we tried to contact him, and we did. And we got a script to him. He said, yeah, send it over. I'd love to take a look at it. And he read it, and he loved it. And he attached himself to the project right away. So from there, you know, we had David, and we went out, and we had held castings in New York and L.A., and just ended up getting these amazing actors like Jane Addams and Anne Cusack. And Elizabeth Waterston's a newcomer. She's great. And Daniel Gillies and Ian Somerhalder and Scott Wilson. It was very, very fortunate. And we all became this family. And during the shoot of the film, we all lived in a bed and breakfast mm-hmm. together. So we became like this real sort of ragtag bohemian type of family.
I read that you shot it in a very short period of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. 18 days.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's definitely the nature of independent film. You have a limited number of days. You have X amount of pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters to sort of get the thing done. And when the days and the coins are gone, the film is done, and it is what it is. And you basically just try to find some sort of beautiful moment that hopefully someone will find worthwhile.
The editing and cinematography are obviously crucial to making this film work, because you are sustaining this mood and these set of very intense characters. And in fact, the film won an award for cinematography at the Durban International Film Festival.
Yeah.
Tell us about the collaboration with your cinematographer. How did it work, especially in such a tight shooting schedule?
He's cinematographer Christophe Lanzenberg. He's a French fellow from Los Angeles. Our collaboration and our friendship thus has just been amazing. And one of the things was coming into the project is we knew that we didn't have a lot of time. And also my big influences cinematically are more, you know, European and specifically Eastern European and Russian filmmakers like Andrei Tarkovsky from Russia, or people like Robert Bresson from France and Carl Dreyer and whatnot. And so I wanted to take this sort of classic sort of mise-en-scene approach. And Christophe is just, he has this, he's French, and there's this French saying, c'est l'œil qui compte, which means, you know, it's all about the eye. And Christophe just has this impeccable eye. Remember, we had limited monies, we had limited resources, and what he was able to capture was absolutely fantastic. And what made our collaboration work is that there was no sort of territorial thing where, you know, I definitely am not about ruling a set in a dictatorial sort of fashion, and Christophe isn't, you know, uptight, and he's very loose and free. So we knew that we had to go with the flow, bring the actors into the space once we secured locations, and the goal was to basically just sort of paint pictures and try to find these moments and just let the poetry sort of come out of that. And he's just an amazing person to work with, and we will continue to work together, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, neither of you seems to be afraid of taking a shot long and slow. I mean, it's a movie that I saw it on a screen or on a small TV set. I'd love to see it on the big screen. Because,
yeah, I hope you do.
Yeah. Let's see. What kind of distribution has the film gotten?
Well, as far as distribution is concerned, right now, we've four-walled it. We're self-distributing theatrically because we wanted to really, you know, we realized that, you know, the film isn't, you know, it's not your blockbuster, feel-good, hit-of-the-summer type of a film. You know, it's very much, you know, an art film. It's more poetic and lyrical in nature. So, you know, we need to take time with it and really try to nurture it and try to find the audience for it. So with that being the case, we started. We spent the whole year, we've been making the festival circuit for a year, and then we just began a limited theatrical release, doing it all ourselves, starting in the Northeast, where we filmed it, we're from New Hampshire, and releasing it into theaters there, building support for it, moving out into Massachusetts, you know, Maine, Vermont, the whole New England area, down the eastern seaboard, and then we're just going to slowly open it up wider across the country and try to get more theaters and then bring in some other partnerships with some companies that can help us with some of the larger markets. It's a long, drawn-out process. You know, it's a real sort of marathon.
Well, it's a long film, too, and it's, as you say, it's an art film and poetic, but it is gripping from beginning to end, at least I thought so. And
oh, thanks.
I hope it works out for you. The film is at the Santa Fe Film Center on St. Michael's Drive, where you can sit on wonderful couches and watch this film. Aaron Wiederspahn, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, Mary Charlotte, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay. We will take a little break right now and stay tuned to KSFR. Right now, I'd like to welcome Amy Irvine. She is the author of the book Trespass, Living at the Edge of the Promised Land. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this is a memoir about a time in your life when you moved to southeastern Utah. You moved after the death of your father. Why did you choose that place?
That is a question I have yet to be able to answer well. I think I knew that I was my father's daughter and that more civilized places, more crowded places were not the best for me. And he and my grandfather, who was a fifth-generation rancher, both taught me a love of big landscape. And I think after my father committed suicide, it was inspiration to go where he hadn't gone in time. I also had the inspiration of falling in love with a man who already lived down near the edge of this particular county. And I wanted to move deeper into the desert than the community he lived in, but it was closer. So I had, I think, two men that were inspiring me at once.
And you are half Mormon, which I gather is unusual because Mormons don't intermarry very much.
That's correct. There are contradictions. Well, they abound everywhere in the family. Half the family is rural Mormon ranching, my mother's side, and my father's side are all urban intellectuals. The irony of this is that my father's side, who are now what Mormons refer to as Gentiles, they're the ones with the impressive Mormon pedigree. My great-great-great-grandfather on that side was one of Brigham Young and Joseph Smith's original bodyguards and one of the very first hand-picked Mormons to make the trek across in search of their promised land.
And which is in the title of the book, Living at the Edge of the Promised Land. And we'll talk about the title in just a few minutes. But what is the culture of Mormonism like in this small town that you moved into, in the middle of ranching country?
It's a very, very different breed. And I actually have a very short section I could read to you about that.
Great.
Because it is so unique from the Mormonism that interfaces with the rest of the world. I am driving en route to my new home in southeastern Utah to San Juan County in this scene. This is my heritage. This is what comes with me in the U-Haul, part of the baggage I convey to San Juan County. I am ambivalent about this legacy, my place in it, and it is through this lens of uncertainty that I now look upon the Mormon temple in Monticello. Since birth, I have lived in the shadow of such a building, but this one stands in what is true outback country, an icon that exemplifies not only how saturated the West is with Mormon history and tradition, but just how deftly the religion appeals to a variety of worlds. The temple of my childhood stood amid an urban epicenter, and though that center was predominantly Mormon, it was a relatively sophisticated and worldly brand of faith, if only by necessity. But San Juan County has changed little since the first Mormon pioneers settled the area. It is a relic of the oldest kind. Its people and culture seem to outsiders not only oppressive, but nearly prehistoric in their ways. The temple before me represents a different kind of Mormonism, less diluted, more insulated, almost oblivious to the machinations of the outside world.
And so this is San Juan County. It's the southeast corner of the Four Corners area. What do people do there? Is it really mostly ranching?
It was mostly ranching. Unfortunately, ranching along with, you know, all the small family farms and local industries seem to be getting lost in this new economy, in this new West. And so more and more the young people are leaving to go find different kinds of jobs. But there's not much else down there other than extractive industry. So either you work for oil and gas or mining, or you try and eke it out in a really arid landscape as a rancher.
So you were working with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance.
I was.
And one of the things that's so interesting about the book is the culture clash between people who are really working for wilderness and then the locals there who've been there for quite a long time. Mm. What was that like? I mean, there's all these painful moments where you're trying to be accepted by the local people, but you are working with this organization and you're sort of like not telling people about it because they think that the Wilderness Alliance is a bunch of wacko extremists.
Yeah, it was interesting how I went down there thinking that my Mormon pedigree, my credentials, and the fact that these were my people on many levels, that that would somehow give me an entree into the community. And it's very easy to be the ardent environmentalist when you live in an urban area. But to
or
go
Santa
into,
Fe. Or, yeah.
Exactly. But to go into the heart of a county that feels very persecuted by the federal government.
In what way does it feel persecuted by the federal government?
Well, this is part of what the book examines, is there have been land use battles all over the West, but nowhere have they been more colorful than in Utah, and that is very much because of the Mormon heritage and the sense of persecution they've had ever since they were chased out of three eastern settlements.
So you're, in a way, they're waiting for persecution, and when anything that looks like persecution comes along, that's what it feels like, and that's what it is.
Exactly. The last thing they want is the federal government in there or any outsider telling them what to do. But I didn't consider myself that much of an outsider. I felt like it was my homeland. I felt like I knew these people. And that I inhabited a certain fence. And when I started to write this book, and when I went down there, I was more strident in my views. And as time went on, I realized I empathize with rural folks a whole lot more than I realized, and this is part of my need to belong. This is part of my fear of really putting my foot down and drawing the bright line in the sand around wilderness, and that I was slowly developing a certain insanity or schizophrenia over this fence that I inhabited. And every time I started to write about this, I would envision the quintessential Western coyote strung up on the barbed wire fence, a stranger in his own land, this persecuted creature, which I think a lot of people in the West feel like, especially those who've grown up in a Mormon community and don't feel like they quite fit in. And I finally came to terms with the fact that I wasn't ever going to inhabit easily either side of the fence, and that my story was hung up on that fence. And once I got comfortable with that, it was easier for me to write this book as well as interface with people who had different views than I did, at least in the political sense, and the religious sense. I would say that when it came down to it, we had a whole lot more in common than one might realize.
We're talking to Amy Irvine. The book is called Trespass, Living at the Edge of the Promised Land. And that thing of what you have in common and what you don't have in common is something that we have a lot of these issues in New Mexico, and I was thinking how different it would be to take this book to New England versus people in the West reading it. But, for example, you have you and environmentalists and wilderness advocates and cowboys and ranchers and people who have been there forever who all love the land.
Exactly.
But they do it in very different ways, and their philosophies about what is dangerous and what should be there are really different.
They're very different, and yet on the most fundamental levels they're the same. And I think that that's my ultimate point in the book, is that we've seen this happen time and again, and I examine sort of the prehistory on the Colorado Plateau and in the West, and how there was a time when thinking was less divided, less black and white, less dualistic, and that was all the way back in hunter-gatherer times, but it was a very long, successful, and peaceful period in human history by all indicators that we have.
Now we're talking about the wonderful hunter-gatherers who, you know, had a balanced diet and gender parity and no tooth decay and all these things that we've been talking about before we went on the air.
And people usually roll their eyes and think I'm romanticizing the loincloth and the spear and hurling the spear, and I'm not, but I'm saying that if we evolve for tens of thousands of years with a certain psyche and a certain physiology, and we're not living in accordance with that anymore, no wonder we're living soulless lives. No wonder we're stressed and we have all these stress-related illnesses and mental illnesses. And that if you go back and look at that period, we have something to learn about thinking that is more complex, less dualistic, less fundamental. It's when I know this is not a PC term, but I use the term Anasazi because it has historical context for us. The Anasazi, when they came into vogue and turned to agriculture, that's when we see the stress-related illnesses, the starvation, the malnutrition, the gender disparity, the warring, the cannibalism at points, that's when things fall apart. And interestingly enough, the rock art begins to decline, and the spiritual life, although it's getting more rigorous and more intense and more fundamental, it's getting less soulful. And so anyway, I use a lot of these parallels to look at where we're headed now and to just probe how we might find a new relationship with the desert, which I think we all have on that deep genetic level. And and that I think, is where the hope is. The wilderness debate, public lands debate at this point, is completely polarized.
Well, what tell us about that polarity. What does each group deeply believe?
Well, it's getting more complex, interestingly enough, and I'll explain that why in a minute. But we have the environmentalists, the public lands advocates in the West are basically, for the most part, saying we need to protect as much as possible. This new West is destroying the desert so rapidly, and just the demographic shifts into the West. We don't have enough water. How are we going to deal with these issues? We need to lock up as much land as we can. And the other side is saying we have been here for generations working the land. America needs to eat. We need to produce our own food and our own resources, and that's why we have public lands, especially BLM-managed lands. We have enough places protected. We don't want any more federal intrusion. I appreciate both sides, and I suggest by the end of the book that there's something more fundamental underneath that, and that we have to get back to whatever that common denominator is, which, again, I think hints at our true deep roots, our true attachment to landscape. And I actually have another quick little scene in the book where the man whom I have fallen in love with, who this is very much a love story too at its heart, he and I are driving up the Blue Mountain Road in the Abajos in San Juan County on Christmas Day, and we find a coyote who's just been shot, and he's been strung up on the fence. And my now husband couldn't bear it, and he got out to remove the coyote and give him a proper burial. We've hiked out into some trees. And this is what happens. A truck hauling bales of hay approaches, a rancher most likely taking winter feed to cows still in the foothills. He sees my truck, comes to a stop, and with his eyes follows our footprints into the woods. We can see him, but the trees obscure us from his view. Just then, a small herd of mule deer jump the fence and bound across the road in front of him. He turns to watch. As a deer brush through the trees on the other side of the road, the boughs sift sugar snow, and a flock of dark-eyed juncos rushes out. In that moment, the man's expression is both serenity and delight. It is the look of a man who loves his place in the world, a place he knows in his bones and would do anything to defend. And in him, I can see a certain knowing. This is a man who will do his chores and return to his family, an entire tribe of grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, wife, children. They will share the holiday, and tomorrow they will go to church. There they will mingle with the greater tribe like their own, whose men will drift off to speak of the land, of the good God that gave it to them, and make arrangements to help the man get his cows down into the low country before the big snows hit. My point here is that I appreciate his place and his connection to landscape. And what's happening now is that these rural folks that have been there for such a long time are now seeing this new West, the new populations coming in, these ranchettes, these subdivision of family ranches and farms, oil and gas development, now uranium mining again, off-road vehicle recreation. A lot of these things, these traditional families, many of them are now coming to put organizations like the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance and saying, don't use my name, but we've got some problems on our property, and the place is going to hell in a handbasket. So there's new gray areas, new
openings. And alliances.
Exactly. And I find that that's where the possibilities are, and we just have to stop. And it was, the book ultimately chronicles the near demise of my own marriage, and it wasn't until that happened that I realized it's the same for any relationship that involves intimacy and community. You have to step away from being entrenched in your position and find that gray area with the nuances, and that's the only place that possibility happens. And nowhere is that more true than in a marriage, as we all know. And we're living in a culture that has a greater than 50% divorce rate. Something's got to give.
We're talking to Amy Irvine. One of the things that is so interesting is the way you trace a kind of anti-environmentalism back to and connect it to Mormonism.
Yes. The more I researched Mormon history, because I was finding that the more I understood where my quote-unquote adversaries were coming from, the more appreciation I had for their experience, and we could actually find new language and new ways to have a discussion. beyond the same old tired rhetoric that I was hearing every time I stepped out on the street. And as I did this research, I realized that Brigham Young's, the line he drew around what he called the Kingdom of Deseret, which once they came out to the Salt Lake Valley, he didn't want just Utah. He drew a line around part of Oregon, a large chunk of California, all of Nevada, part of Arizona, New Mexico, a bit of Colorado, a bit of Wyoming and Idaho, and all of Utah.
And that was Deseret.
It was enormous. And if you look at where the public lands debates are today, the most heated ones, especially over wilderness designation, they're in former Deseret, wherever a Mormon outpost has been established. And so I suggest in the book that I think the whole wilderness debate is more Mormon in its roots than we realize, the contention over it. And understandably so, because not only did the Mormons have this issue with federal persecution, but they also had a very, as much as they are attached to this land, a very adversarial relationship to it. There are passages in the book that I refer to that I found in diaries of the pioneers coming across the plains. By the time they got here, their journey just to get to Utah, let alone settle on the Colorado Plateau, was brutal. And they did have to fight tooth and nail to survive. And so that...
Yeah, nature doesn't seem so benign when you're really trying to get through it in the absence of any kind of other amenities.
Exactly. And I think that that's what I've had callers call in on some of the interviews I've done or some of the question and answers at the readings I've done in bookstores of people saying, yeah, those people, those rural people, really are loving the land to death. And I say, the urbanites are too. It's really easy for us to love the landscape the way we do when we have our nice, cozy SUVs and we live here with all our amenities. But living...
And do car camping.
It's a very different thing to live in the desert than it is to recreate in it.
So there's a chapter in your book about the Heavenly Mother, which is a figure that has vanished from the Mormon psyche.
Yes. Toward the end of the book, part of my own spiritual journey, for lack of a better word, my own psychic crisis, as my marriage is dissolving and I'm watching the landscape that I love just come unraveled at every turn with, after 9/11, the oil and gas development stepped up tenfold. Off-road vehicle events, organized and unorganized, had taken over every corner of the desert. And I was really in a place of hopelessness. And it suddenly occurred to me one day that in Mormonism there is not even a single angel. There's not even an image of the Virgin Mary to turn to that is female. And without any feminine divine, Mormon women are in sort of a unique place because they can't see themselves in the face of God, for lack of better words to use. And that I had grown up in this culture that I couldn't see my own divine, you know, my own something, and that was part of my hopelessness. And as you pointed out before we got on the air, that very well may have something to do with our dissociation from the land. If we've dissociated from half of what makes us whole, the mother, the feminine, then how could we ever have a connection to landscape that sustains us in very much the same way?
You sort of don't want to get too much into this woman as nature, man as rational being thing.
No, not at all. I don't want to be that divided. I think that they are two sides of the same coin, and that it's sort of just part of thinking holistically about ourselves, our own psyches, about our relationship to the earth or to something, you know, more esoteric. I think it's dangerous territory to tread upon, but I think it's telling that the Heavenly Mother has been absolutely excised from every corner of Mormon theology and every...
She used to be there, and she was, photoshopped out.
Every academic, every historian, every layperson that has mentioned her existence has been excommunicated from the church.
Oh, my goodness.
That's pretty intense.
Well, are you in the church? Would you be excommunicated?
I guess we'll see.
Are you part of the Mormon church?
Yes, I was baptized Mormon, and this is very much my story of being half Mormon, half not, and my struggle to get baptized, and my struggle to be a child of God after that and not being able to be, and then my turn away from the church that, you know, was a pretty angry, passionate descent, and then sort of finding my own self amid all these things, because reacting to them was as bad as buying into them.
Right.
I have one last little passage here that sort of, I think, summarizes some of these things that we're talking about. And it does come back to the coyote on the fence. God, dog. We fail to see the reflexivity of what lives inside us. Henry David Thoreau wrote, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." He did not say wilderness. He knew that no piece of land, no matter how scenic or pristine, would restore what we have lost in ourselves. That's not to say we don't need wilderness. I think we need it more than ever. For this is the place where coyote dwells, free of persecution, free of the projection of the abandoned, feared self. In coyote is the preservation of the soul. That howl, had I let it rise up into the dark night sky like a prayer, would have grounded me. And at the same time, it would have gotten me out of the house, nose to the ground, loping circles until I found my way. There would have been no map, and I would not have followed any sort of marked route. And what it would not have been the Mormon version of the celestial kingdom, white tile and golden streets I would have found. It would have been untrammeled desert, a landscape of faith, desire, and imagination, a landscape of the other. Scattered across it would be bones, old bones, stained in ancient red. Among them would have been the most original skull, not too large, with a pointed muzzle and sharp teeth. Male or female, it wouldn't have mattered. It would have been the face of God. Pray or crawl. I never imagined the voice as anything except either or. But really, for thousands of years, they were one and the same.
Amy Irvine is the author of the book Trespass, Living at the Edge of the Promised Land. We will take a little break right now and stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Aaron Feuerstein. He is the retired former owner and CEO of Malden Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. Your story is a famous one, but probably not everybody's heard it. First of all, tell us the story of Malden Mills, the nature of the business, and how you learned that business.
Okay. I went into the business, almost 60 years ago. And we were in the textile business.
Your parents' ancestors?
Yes, my father and my grandfather. The corporation was founded in 1906 in Malden, Massachusetts. And my father was president, and then I came into the company. And originally they were in the sweater business, and I moved it off into the fabric business, and we made fleece. And we invented Polartec fleece, which is sold to companies like Patagonia, North Face, Lands End, etc.
And unfortunately, I was reading you didn't patent that fleece, and so now there's a million spinoffs of fleece.
Yes, but even though we didn't patent it at that time, and perhaps it was a mistake, I don't know. And I'm no longer connected with the company. I'm retired, but. I was told at the time that if you patent, since you're dealing a great deal with China, and China has very little respect for patents, that you're almost better off just keeping it secret. And we always had a policy in our company that we would only manufacture them in the United States, we wouldn't offshore, and we had to have compassion for the worker, and we had unions in our company. So we didn't patent it, but we did have a policy in addition to make the very best quality that we knew how to make, and that would be our protection.
And was it?
Yes, it was. And we not only made the best quality, but we were the only mill that I know of that actually branded the fabric so that when the consumer came into the store to buy the Patagonia jacket, he knew that the fabric in it, the Polartec fleece, was made by Malden Mills, and that was the guarantee of quality.
So in December of 1995, there was a fire, and this is what makes your story so unusual. You decided at that point not only to use the insurance money to rebuild the factory instead of moving it overseas or keeping it or whatever, but also you paid the salaries and full benefits of all the unemployed workers while the factory was being rebuilt, 3,000 employees for what, 2 or 3 months. This is very unusual in business.
Yes, very, very unusual. But interestingly, back in 1865, when the Arlington Mills in Lawrence, Mass. Started, and that's the very same premises where Malden Mills is today. They had a fire, and they actually rehired everybody and took care of everybody, and it, you know, no excitement to it, because in those days, that was the value system. And today, what I did went against the value system of today, unfortunately, and so that's why it received so much public recognition. So in a certain sense, maybe I don't deserve that public recognition. It's just that things are so bad today.
Well, it's funny, when you think of the mid to late 19th century value system, I think of child labor in the mills.
Yes, there maybe was child labor. I don't know. I mean, I had no connection with it in those days. But they did have a feeling that the laborer was a stakeholder and to take care of them.
I mean, you've been quoted as saying the worker is an asset rather than an expense.
He is an asset, because when I said previously that we made the best quality in the world, it was, in my opinion, only because of our good labor. And so our middle-class workers, our blue-collar laborers, they all knew that they had to make the best quality, and they did. And they gave a great deal of trust and loyalty to us, and they expected that in return, and they got it from us.
Now, your religion gave you, to some extent, or maybe a large extent, the basis for your principles in this and many other decisions that you've made as the leader of a business. Tell us how you work with Scripture and the nature of using religion in a practical way.
Okay, you know, when I try to figure out how I got these values, I think they probably were incubated when I was just a little kid. And I remember we always used to sit at our father's table. It was a great honor. We'd all sit together at dinner time in the evening. Nobody does that anymore. And my father and mother would discuss everything, and we all participated in the conversations. We talked about everything in the world. And my father one day told me that told us at the table that when he first went to work, when he was 14 years old, in his father's factory, my grandfather went around each night with a cash envelopes to pay each worker at the end of the day for the work that he did. And when my father told him, well, that's not done here in the United States, you know, you pay the following week, he said, oh, no, that's against the Bible. And the very next day, when I went to have my Hebrew lessons with my maternal grandfather, I asked him, how is it possible that that's against the Bible? It doesn't seem normal. He says, oh, yes, it is. And he showed me in Leviticus where it's written that you can't oppress the worker, and that each day you have to pay him his wages, and that's what keeps him together, because he's poor and needy. And so that kind of storytelling when I was a kid, I'm sure played a big role in the value system that I have today.
We're talking to Aaron Feuerstein, and he was the owner and CEO of Malden Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts. So under what circumstances is working with the kind of principles that you're talking about, you know, non-exploitation, also good business, and under what circumstances does it go against the needs of business, namely making a profit?
Okay. Profitability is, you know, our whole economic system is based on profitability, and it's the fodder that keeps us going and it's the basis of our democracy. There's nothing wrong in profitability, and our family always was interested in profitability, but that profitability had to be done in such a way that we didn't oppress the worker. And we also considered the environment a stakeholder, and we considered the community a stakeholder. And today in business, most of the business schools teach that a 100% profitability to the shareholder is the only objective, and whatever you have to do to result in 100% profitability, you go ahead and do. And the worker is just a pair of hands. And I believe he's the worker was created in the image of God, and he's just as important as the owner of the company.
So, okay, so you have a clothing business or a fabric business, and you do it one way. Somebody else has a fabric business. They do it another way. They split the worker. They sell their fabric for a cheaper price. How do you compete?
Okay, so when we sell our fabric, it's not only on the basis of how cheap we can pay our labor, but it's on how good the fabric is. And we always made the best quality, and we were dedicated to it. And as I told you before, we actually branded our thing. We called it Politech. And that's how we competed. We made the best. And
I would think that works better in some businesses than others.
Yes. People who are in the commodity, dog-eat-dog price end of the business, would have difficulty with it. And because of that reason, I always maintain that I think that the government should set up parameters and regulations so that in the commodity business that the worker is not oppressed.
So it's interesting to hear a businessman and CEO talking about the need for government regulation.
Yes, and I'm sure it's right. You know, most of the economists today, but not all, think in terms of what Adam Smith said, that there's an invisible hand. So that you go about, all the entrepreneurs go about marketing and doing whatever they want to do with greed. But in the end, the invisible hand makes everything work out fine so that it's in the best interest of all people. I don't agree with that premise. And I think that there has to be certain parameters within which the corporation must operate. And can operate, and just taking a business and offshoring the laborers to under a dollar an hour in some foreign land like China or India is not the correct thing to do. And the end result is the laborers in that country are oppressed, and the laborers in our country lose their jobs, or they have to go make a bed somewhere, and they no longer have the benefits and the high wages and the self-dignity of being able to control a family. And the laborer hasn't got the hope of upward mobility for his children, for each generation to get better and better, and that was the hope of America. So I think that if there are certain regulations and parameters, it would be helpful without destroying our democratic principles and without destroying the world trade, the free world trade. I'm not talking against free world trade. I'm talking in favor of some reasonable regulations which would give us enough protection so that our laboring and middle class would be able to succeed in this country.
There was a tremendous reaction to what you did when you rebuilt your factory in Malden and continued to pay your workers and pay full benefits. Did you see people following your footsteps? I mean, it led to certainly a lot of discussion about business ethics.
No, I didn't. There may be a few exceptions, but generally speaking, the average entrepreneur who is and the average CEO who's controlled by a board of directors and by the shareholder, they had no option but to run for the cheapest labor they could get. So it was almost as if the United States wanted the middle class and the laboring class to lose its position. And it's just most unfortunate.
I mean,
and if the trend isn't reversed, in my opinion, this country is looking for big, big trouble. Because what was always wonderful about this country is that the difference between the earnings of the entrepreneur and the laborer was a reasonable kind of difference. And today it's becoming more like underdeveloped countries where you have extremely rich people and the laborers are just, you know, a pair of hands.
I mean, I remember in the 90s, actually going back to the 80s, there were lots of hostile takeovers and moving people overseas, downsizing, going to places where environmental laws were weak, where labor laws were weak. Who benefited from that? I mean, was it really, as people who criticize business say, just simply an upward movement of wealth into the hands of the few?
That's, I think, what it was. It was the few, the intelligent, creative, marketing entrepreneur was the one that got the benefit, and the working class and the middle class lost out. And we have to figure out how to redistribute it and do it differently. I have some great ideas.
Let's hear them.
They're my own ideas, and I don't know if if they would succeed. But in any event, everyone has to come up with ideas of how we can, how to innovate and how to do it so that our great country can continue to succeed. The ideas that I have are, one, that just like here in this country, all our laborers have a minimum wage, and there are certain benefits and certain government protections over the environment, over the health, over the safety, etc., etc. That same thing has to exist in the foreign country that's trying to export into the United States. They can operate whatever way they want in their own country, but if they're going to export into the United States, those products, just like the food, has to come in, it has to pass certain regulations. And so there's the minimum wage and time and a half, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't have to be exactly the same as what's in the United States, but it should be within their currency and what they consider poverty. And I think that can be done. And in that way, even though there still would be some outsourcing and some offshoring, it wouldn't go on at the pace of what's going on here in our country today. And I have another great idea.
Let's hear it.
And that is patent protection. We all accept in our country that the innovator and the one who applies for the patent, the entrepreneur, he's protected from the capitalistic competition because he had the idea. And he goes to the patent office and protected for 20 years. But the very next day, he can make the product with labor from outside the United States instead of labor inside the United States. So if he were required, if he gets a patent in the United States, then that's where he wants it because that's where he'll get the protection. If he wants to get the 20 years, he has to extend that 20 years to his laborers and his middle class. So in that way, the United States would be making the newest product and only losing the oldest kind of product to the world free trade.
That's a great idea.
Thank you.
Well, we're running out of time. What brings you to Santa Fe?
I love Santa Fe. It's a fabulous place. I was at a conference. I was invited to speak at a conference here of business and consciousness. And I told my wife, I have an opportunity to go to Santa Fe, which we both love. And that's why we're here. And instead of staying just for the 3 days of the conference, we stayed a whole week. And it's just splendid.
And so this business and consciousness, what kind of a conference was it? What were people talking about?
They were talking about how to be more humane one to the other and social responsibility. So I was sort of related to that. And so they asked me to talk.
So whatever happened to Malden Mills? Where is it today?
Malden Mills is still operating, one of the few textile companies operating in the United States, but it's no longer under my control, and I'm retired from it, and I don't speak for Malden Mills today, unfortunately.
But they continue to make Polar Tech.
Yes, they do.
So I want to thank you so much for being here, Aaron Feuerstein, and he's the former owner, CEO of Malden Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for being here on the Radio Cafe.
Well, I want to thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista. Ciao. All right.